You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 22nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Stephanie Kelton, on modern monetary theory and what that and how that implicates inequality in this country. Also on the program today, watered down NSA reform passes the House. The author of the bill, Sensenbrenner, regrets that it's been watered down, still supported it. Democrats walk right into the trap and appoint Democratic representatives to the Special Select Committee on Benghazi. Maybe they want a piece of the tote bags and coffee mugs. Who knows? Chris Christie, the hits keep coming. Not only is he reneging on his pension deal from, almost three whole years ago, more revealed by David Sirota at Pando Daily on the pay-to-play pension schemes. And Michael Grimm, more revelations of the congressman who was arrested on federal charges. Turns out he never shed his Mikey Suits suit. Mikey Suits was his alter ego, I guess, when he was undercover for an FBI as an FBI agent 6 years ago. And still, as a congressman, he was maintaining the identity.
You have a name like Mikey Suits. You don't just retire that, all right, Sam?
Right, I
understand. That's a serious name.
I understand. I kept the cell phone just because I was getting a good friends and family discount by having two cell phones. What's so strange about that? Oh. And we'll also talk about the nice gift from Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase to Detroit. $100 million. God, the philanthropy is just wonderful. We will talk about what's really behind that gift. Just a reminder. Oh, and I should say, Ed Schultz last night announced on his TV program that he would be stopping his radio, his daily radio show, from 12 to 3. He's going to replace it with a show not unlike ours, a live podcast, or I don't know if it'll be live. I think it'll be. I'm not 100% sure on that. I'm not clear. But one more reason that if you want progressive media to continue, you got to support it. And you can do so by becoming a member today at majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Stephanie Kelton. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, also Editor-in-Chief of the blog New Economic Perspectives. She also hosts her own podcast, which you should check out, on MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. Stephanie Kelton, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thanks so much. Glad to be back.
So now I want to cover some of the stuff that we talked about. I guess it was now almost 2 years ago in covering some of the basics about modern monetary theory. Now, when we spoke last time, we were dealing with things like the fiscal cliff and the threat by the Republicans to not pay our debt obligations. It's a different time in some respects, and not in more important respects. And specifically, the deficit is about half of where it was, or pretty close, when we spoke. Yet our economic situation, which flies in the face of everything we were told by all of these the great thinkers in Washington, was that our economic situation has not changed in many respects. And so before we get to that, let's just go back and explain this notion of how we're living in a different era in terms of our monetary policy, but we're not but we have yet to sort of adjust to that. So let's go back and just let's talk about Bretton Woods for a moment. What is Bretton Woods? When did that happen? And what has changed since then?
Sure. So Bretton Woods was an international monetary system that was set up after World War II. And the basic thinking was that, you know, the world needed some stability after the war, and that what we ought to do is set up a system where we had fixed exchange rates. So what you had were 44 countries coming together and agreeing to participate in this construction and creation of this monetary system set up to fix the value of one country's currency relative to another country's currency. And so what happened is 43 countries said, we agree it's going to be the U.S. dollar. We'll all fix our currencies to the value of the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll agree to convert dollars into gold at a fixed price. And so it was a form of a gold standard system. It's a fixed exchange rate system, and it was in place, as you said, from 1944, from the end of the war, all the way up until Nixon ended it in 1971. So we went from a system of fixed exchange rates, where one country's currency exchanged for another country's currency at a fixed price, and threw the U.S. dollar into gold at a fixed price, to a system where most currencies in the world today are what we call floating currencies. They're no longer fixed to another country's currency or a basket of currencies or gold or anything else. The value of the currency changes from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute in financial markets. So it's a very different type of monetary system that we have today.
That's right, because when we went off gold in 1971, everything changed. But in some respects, we have yet to really, our policymakers have yet to really adjust to that new world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that there has been a full appreciation. In fact, I think it's pretty clear there hasn't been a full appreciation of the magnitude, the significance of that change, and what it means for policy. So, I mean, I think in terms of the policy space that's available to us, and the policy space was just a whole lot smaller on a gold standard, on a fixed exchange rate system, than it is today now that we're off of that type of system. So we have degrees of freedom available to us that we didn't have under the old monetary arrangements, but we still, because we fail to appreciate that, we act like we're still trapped in an old gold standard framework. You know, it's sort of like the textbooks that were written in the 60s and 50s, where we had that monetary system in place, haven't really been revised a whole lot since then. We sort of repeat the same sorts of stories about the way the economy works and the way government budgets work and so forth, not recognizing that things changed in 71, and we should rewrite the textbooks, because it really does make a whole lot of difference in terms of, you know, the policy options that are available.
All right, so let's talk about those policy options. I mean, what specifically did it free us up to do, and what we're not taking advantage of?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is that when you're pledging to convert your currency, so let's just talk about the U.S., if you're pledging to convert your currency on demand at a fixed price into gold, which is itself something that's finite, then you have to be pretty careful about how much spending you do, how big your deficits get, and so forth, you know, the type of monetary policy that you run, because if you start creating too much of your own currency and people want to convert the currency into gold, but there's only so much gold available, then you can undermine the very foundation of your monetary system. So you've got to be pretty careful about how much you actually spend and how aggressive your monetary policy is and so forth when you're on a system like that. Now, today, because the government doesn't pledge to convert dollars into anything else, it doesn't have to be careful in the same way that it did on a gold standard. It still has to be careful because, of course, you can still get an inflation problem. So what the government can do today that it couldn't do back then is focus exclusively on how much it's adding in terms of spending in the economy relative to how much demand it's taking away by taxing, and it can target economic goals like full employment with a mind only to the inflationary effects in the real economy, and not having to worry about whether it's got enough of this shiny yellow metal to support its monetary system.
Okay, now this is weedy stuff. So I want to sort of
sure.
I want to go back over this so that people really understand this concept. When essentially our dollars were certificates for redemption of gold, it limited the amount that we could print essentially of dollars, because that day that somebody could come in and say, yeah, all the people who have those certificates could come back and say, I want to redeem my certificate. And if we don't have the gold to back that up, we're in big trouble. And like you say, gold is a finite resource. So we can still have inflation. But tell us how inflation was created in that scenario. Tell us what the danger was. What would happen back when we were on the gold standard if that came to pass, where people say, I want the gold now?
Mm-hmm. So, well, what happens is if governments are promising to convert their currency into something else, and there's only so much of that thing, then what happens when people start demanding the underlying asset, they want the gold or they want somebody else's currency, the government tries to protect its foreign exchange reserves, its gold or the other country's currency or whatever. And the way that it tries to protect it is by offering people an alternative. So the government could say, look, don't convert your dollars into gold because we're worried that we're running out of gold. We don't want you to do that. How about instead you agree to convert your dollars into U.S. treasuries? And people say, no, we don't want to convert to treasuries. We really want gold. And government says, well, no, I really think you should take the treasury. Look here, I'll pay you more interest. It makes it more appealing. And I say, well, no, I still really think I want the gold. Well, how about if I offer this interest rate? And so interest rates become the tool that government uses to try to protect its reserve asset, whether it's gold or somebody else's currency. And so that's the real danger, is that you lose control of the interest rate. And so, you know, interest rates start going up, and then all of a sudden you get all sorts of problems in your economy because people won't borrow and spend at higher rates of interest. And so what it liberates you from, having a currency that's not convertible, not tied to gold or some other country's currency, is that it frees governments from having to use their interest rates as a mechanism to compete with the ability of people to convert their dollars into something else. And so you can keep interest rates low. You can try to provide the right climate for, you know, borrowers and folks and businesses or households to borrow at low interest rates and buy homes or cars or refrigerators or whatever it is. It's supposed to be a better tool for central banks to be able to, you know, kind of tweak the economy by making these modest adjustments in interest rates over time and not completely losing control of interest rates because they're trying to protect gold reserves.
So, in other words, the government does not have to automatically worry about printing more money. It is they don't have to worry about they don't have to fight on two fronts in some ways, right? They don't have to worry about their rear guard in terms of what they have for gold. They just have to worry about what the situation is in the economy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It frees them of the need to obsess over the foreign exchange reserves or the gold reserves. That's exactly right.
And so when people, you know, I remember sitting in a green room with David Stockman. Let's refrain from sort of from judging from judging from whence he comes to formulate his opinions. But he was one of those people who are just like, it is all going to come crashing down. We have the another round of quantitative easing, and we're going to turn into Weimar Republic. We're going to turn into Zimbabwe. Explain to us why, what happened with Weimar, the Weimar Republic, and what happened with Zimbabwe, and why that's not a problem for us in the circumstance we are in now.
Okay. So Stockman's concern, of course, is sort of widely held. And lots of people looked at what the Fed was doing and cried hyperinflation, Weimar, and all that sort of stuff because their models tell them so. So, you know, in economics, people sometimes put their hand over their heart when they hear the name Milton Friedman and, you know, the models that were taught in economics are that if you increase the money supply or the rate of growth of the money supply, you get proportionate increases in prices or in the inflation rate. And so people just anticipate that's the way it's supposed to work. So they saw the Fed doing QE, and it looks like printing money, and their, you know, hearts tell them, well, if the Fed is printing money, we're going to get inflation. If they're printing lots of money, we're going to get high inflation or hyperinflation. And then they make, you know, these analogies to Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. So what happened, you know, I'm not a historian, but I've studied this a little bit, and with Germany, what you had was, of course, Germany loses the war, is paying reparations, so there are war reparations. Germany's trying to acquire gold in order to pay reparations, and so they're printing lots of Deutschmarks to buy gold. At the same time, you have the French and the Belgians come in and occupy a big section of the industrial production facilities in Germany. And so you have the sort of old Milton Friedman problem of too much money chasing too few goods, which results in inflation. But the reason you have too much money is not because you have some technocrat trying to, you know, manage the economy and achieve full employment, but because you're printing Deutschmarks to buy gold to pay reparations, and then you've lost a part of your productive capacity, so you can't produce the goods and services that money is now going to chase. And so very complex sort of thing going on there. It's not the good old-fashioned, you know, an economy that gets overheated in normal times that generates inflation. It's happening on the supply side, and it's much more complex sort of a thing going on. And in the case of Zimbabwe, you know, you have Mugabe come to power, and one of the things he does is redistribute land, and he takes land away from white farmers and redistributes it to black farmers with little and, in many cases, no farming experience. And so what ends up happening is that you get food shortages. And again, you know, this is not the kind of thing that you get because the Fed is doing QE. You've got all sorts of stuff happening on the supply side of the economy that allows too much money to end up with too few goods to chase. So there are ways to explain hyperinflation, but there's an interesting study that was done, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I think, by two economists from the Cato Institute. So this is a, you know, libertarian think tank. And, It was the study was done by a guy named Steve Hanke, and I always forget the other guy's name, but they spent 3 years doing this research, and they said, okay, what we want to do is we want to understand what causes hyperinflation. So we're going to do this comprehensive study where we look at every single case of hyperinflation that has ever occurred on planet Earth, and we want to study it and understand what caused it. And they found 56 cases of hyperinflation anywhere in the world ever in the history of time. And then they did an analysis, said, okay, in this case it was caused by this, in this case it was caused by this. And the most interesting thing about their study is not what it shows or reveals, but what isn't there. And what isn't there is in none of those cases, 56 examples, you'd never have had hyperinflation in an otherwise well-functioning democracy. You get hyperinflation when you have, you know, a civil breakdown, you have a coup, you have the loss of a war, you have supply-side shocks like the, you know, food that I mentioned in Zimbabwe. There's always something more complex going on than just that simple printing money story that most people, I think, have in their heads.
And as far as I understand the way you're explaining it, in Germany, they were printing money for the sake of getting buying gold, and and so the causal connection was sort of reversed in some way as to why they were printing money. They weren't printing money to drive demand, because demand was already there. What wasn't there was the ability to meet that demand, and that's back into your story. And that's so having addressed that, let's talk about we came through this financial crisis, or we're still in the wake of this financial crisis. There was all these pushing for austerity, which I think I hope at least now has been largely debunked as a response to dealing with this big output gap, right? I mean, because we didn't have the what happened is the demand basically went away in that instance. And so what we should have been doing during that time, and I would argue probably still, is increasing demand. And so tell us how that would, I mean, how would with the knowledge of modern monetary theory, how would we have responded to this crisis differently?
Well, I'm not even sure that you need modern monetary theory to get the right policy response. I think, you know, just understanding essentially Keynesian economics, the philosophy there would be what you just said, which is if you've got an output gap, the indication is that there's not enough total spending in the economy to buy all the stuff that businesses are capable of producing. If you want to get back to full employment, you've got to increase spending. And so where MMT comes in handy, I think, is in allowing you to recognize how much policy space is available so that you don't, out of one side of your mouth, talk about advocating for more spending and more aggressive fiscal policy, and out of the other side of your mouth, you're worrying about what's going to happen to the deficit and, you know, talking about the need to balance budgets longer term. So, you know, looking at the economy and what happened after the Great Recession, you're seeing an economy that was hemorrhaging jobs. I mean, at one point we were losing close to 800,000 jobs a month. So why do workers lose their jobs? Well, they lose their jobs because firms are laying them off. And why do they do that? Well, because they don't have the customers buying their goods and services at a price that will turn a profit for them. And so it's pretty straightforward. If capitalism runs on sales. And so the way to stem the loss there is to make sure that there are customers in the stores, that you've got the sales, because it's sales that that firms are looking for. And when sales return robustly, business, that's the clearest indication to businesses that it's safe to start hiring and investing again. So what would we have done? Well, I think probably much more aggressive. My colleagues and I were calling very early on in 2009 for a full payroll tax holiday. So, you know, this is the most direct way to put money in the hands of those who are most likely to spend it. So you've got about 151 million Americans working for a living and paying into Social Security. If we had reduced payroll tax withholdings, that FICA that you see on your paycheck, if we had just reduced that to zero for a period of time, it would have resulted in something close to $300 more a month in take-home pay for the average worker. You're looking at, you know, close to $700 a month for a couple making just a little bit above the average, and that's significant. So, you know, we were looking at an economy where the private sector was trying to deleverage. Households had too much debt, and many people were not going to go out and start borrowing and spending and kickstart the economy. They wanted to pay down debt. So a payroll tax holiday would be great for something like that. Put the money back in the hands of the people, and they will do one of two things. Probably they will pay down debt if they're struggling with high debt levels, and those who weren't would go out and spend some or most of that income. And so, you know, that's something that we would have done. We would have been more aggressive on aid to state and local governments, recognizing that state governments aren't like the federal government. They don't issue the currency, and they are dependent upon the ability to collect taxes and borrow in order to spend, and most of them have to balance their budgets. And so we would have been much more aggressive there in assisting state and local governments. And then finally, we like the idea of a jobs program modeled on the old New Deal programs like the WPA to CCC, the National Youth Administration, where, you know, for those folks who didn't find employment after the other programs were put in place, well, you offer a job for anybody who's ready, willing, and able to work, but not able to find work in the economy, and you do what Roosevelt did. You now, create employment opportunities for them.
Now, I should say that I'm contractually obligated to myself to say that I had a political problem with a moratorium on payroll taxes, simply mm-hmm. because and I think there were a lot of others who felt this way, that this would end up being a very good argument that for those who look to cut Social Security benefits, that we need to cut Social Security benefits because of this moratorium. I would have much preferred the sort of the George Bush style, we're sending to everybody, we've collected your taxes, mm-hmm. now we're going to give you a rebate from the general fund. That's more of a political question than it is an economic one. Now, the reason why we didn't do those things was because people were so concerned about the deficit and the debt here. And explain to people how in a time where we have such a low demand, that when the government actually shrinks its deficit and then ultimately begins to shrink its debt, this is taking money out of people's hands.
Okay, so, you know, let's take an example and put some numbers to it, because I think it might be more helpful that way. If I say the government is spending $100, let's say dollars, into the economy, and they're taking 90 out by collecting taxes, then we label that a deficit. The government is running a deficit of 10. And we're so trained, we're so accustomed to thinking in terms of the deficit as being something that's undesirable and something, you know, it's something that's wrong and it ought to be fixed, that we forget that the 10 goes somewhere. If they spend 100 in and they take 90 out, somebody else ended up with the 10. And the 10 shows up in the non-government part of the economy. And so the government's deficit is, I like to call it the accounting record of a surplus somewhere else in the economy. But we don't think of it as a surplus because we forget about the other side of the balance sheet. And that's a real problem, you know. So we talk about, you know, Simpson-Bowles, and we say, well, Simpson-Bowles has a plan to reduce the government's deficit by $4.1 trillion over the next 10 years. People say, well, that sounds great, right? That's massive deficit reduction. Good for us. And then if you say the sentence differently and you say Simpson-Bowles has a plan to reduce non-government surpluses by $4.1 trillion over the next 10 years, people would say, why would they do that? That doesn't sound like a very good idea. Why would you want to reduce non-government surpluses? But they're identical statements. They're just looked at from two different sides of the ledger. And so it's a real problem getting, I think, doing the education that's required to allow people to feel more empowered in these discussions about the need to reduce deficits, because since everybody is so convinced that deficits are a bad thing and it's in our national interest to reduce them, I mean, people go so far as to saying they're, you know, the deficit is the greatest threat to national security or something. Well, I mean, God, any patriotic American would then say, okay, well, what do we have to do to get rid of the threat? And then, you know, our public officials tell us, well, we need shared sacrifice. And we say, well, okay, you know, I'm willing to do my part because I love my country, so let's get that deficit down.
Now the interesting thing is that there really isn't a government economy and a private economy, right? I mean, there's the economy, and there's, you could say, there's a government sector, and you could say there's a private sector, but you could also say there's also a healthcare sector. There's also a, a building cars sector, I guess. I mean, that seems to be the problem, is that people don't, there's this sense that if the government takes your taxes, that somehow that money goes, sort of evaporates into another plane of existence and does not end up back in somebody's hands somewhere. And that's a human being in our society who's theoretically going out to the same stores as anybody else.
Well, I mean, that happens when they spend it back in. That's what the spending part does. It puts it somewhere in the economy. But the taxing part definitely does remove it. I mean, it does, in a sense, evaporate, right? It if they only collected the tax but they didn't spend it back in, then it's not going to show up anywhere else
right.
in the economy.
Right.
So you need those, right? You need those two things happening. So if they put in 100 and take out 90, then you've got 10 showing up somewhere.
Right. The problem is if you tax simply with the purpose of cutting your deficit and don't actually spend mm-hmm. that money, that's where the problem is. And decouple.
Sure.
Okay. And so let's,
yeah, sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the purposes of taxes, because there's a misunderstanding of why we need to collect taxes in this age if we are freed from a policy standpoint when we have a lack of demand in the economy. Tell us what the purposes of taxes are.
Well, taxes do a lot of things in the economy. They certainly have impacts and there are implications for the distribution of income, right? On whom taxes fall most heavily, where you collect and so forth, has distributional effects. But the one clear thing that taxes do is they take purchasing power by taking income away from someone. That's every dollar that is taxed away from you is a dollar that you don't have to do one of two things with, save or spend. And so taxes remove, by removing income, remove purchasing power from the economy. That's really important sort of thing that taxes do. This is something that, you know, used to be widely recognized by economists, by Fed chairs and so forth, that this gave the government a powerful lever that it could pull when it was trying to manage an overheating economy. And so if you began to see inflation because, you know, your economy was up against its constraints in terms of being able to produce more stuff, but demand was running really high, well, then government could grab that tax lever and pull on it and cool things off. So you raise taxes, you take away income, people spend less. And so that's really one of the most important functions that taxes serve in the economy. And in contrast, if your economy is running cold, then you just push the lever in the other direction. You leave more income in the hands of people who you think are most likely to go out and spend that additional income.
So just, I mean,
but we tend to think of taxes really differently, right? We think of taxes as the mechanism by which the government gets money, and that the federal government, in order to be able to spend dollars, has to get the dollars from somewhere. We think that they need to get them from us because we have the dollars and they don't. And so they come to us and collect the dollars and then they spend the dollars. But if you think about it, it really doesn't make any sense. I mean, the United States government has a monopoly on the creation of the currency. They are the monopoly issuer of the U.S. dollar. It can't come from anywhere else. You know, a lot of stuff's made in China, but not U.S. dollars. The United States government says we claim the sole authority to issue the United States dollar. And if you do it and get caught, well, that's called counterfeiting. So we create the currency. It comes from us. And so this idea that somehow governments are revenue constrained, that they can't spend until they first come find the dollar somewhere, have to go out and get it, you know, is really getting things quite backwards.
So just to clarify for people, when you say the economy runs hot, that is a function of demand outpacing supply. When it's cool, like we have now, supply outpaces demand. And it is that dynamic, the hot dynamic, which creates inflation, because if you have a lot of people who want to buy a car, then the guy selling the car is going to say, all right, I'll give it to the highest bidder. And prices go up that way. So taxes function to cool down an economy where the demand is outstripping the supply. We should also say that I think, I believe you agree with this. Taxes also give value to our money insofar as, that is, it gives value to the currency because the government's saying we'll only accept no chickens, no sheep, no firstborn. We're only going to accept the money that we tender to pay off your taxes. So you owe this, and basically people go out and try and get money.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is something you can find that exact same argument that you just made in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, and you can find it running, you know, all the way through hundreds of years later into the work of Nobel Prize winning economists like James Tobin or Paul Samuelson. It's not a really controversial idea, although it's not something that's usually emphasized by economists. But that's right. I mean, the government gets to declare how it's going to make its payments and in what form it's going to receive payments to itself. And we're all subject to tax obligations, and they get to tell us what we need to get in order to pay our taxes. And so the ability that the government has to make and enforce those tax laws gives value to whatever thing they say we have to have. And in the U.S., of course, it's the U.S. dollar. Like in Germany, when they had the Deutschmark, they asked the people in poll after poll, do you want to give up the Deutschmark and go for a common currency in a part of Europe? People said, absolutely not. We love the Deutschmark. We're never giving it up. It's so stable. We work so hard to get here. No, we don't want any part of this monetary union thing. Well, it didn't matter, right, that they really loved the Deutschmark as soon as Germany said we're in, and henceforth we're only going to be making payments in euros, and we're only going to take euros in payment to us. Well, the euro suddenly had value, and everybody was willing to work for it and accept it and so forth. So, yes, I do agree with you.
All right, so let's turn to inequality. You tweeted the other day, I wonder if Hillary Clinton will run on a commitment to balancing the budget and addressing inequality and how that will turn out. Now, if she did so, she would not be unique, would be my guess. And in some respects, that is just sort of the conventional wisdom. So tell us why that's problematic. Obviously, you know, the last time we spoke, it was all there was a lot more talk about the debt and the deficit than there is now. And like I say, it's the deficit has been halved, and that hasn't quite brought us to nirvana. But people are far more conscious of inequality. Thomas Piketty's book is all the rage now. Why won't that work? Why are those two things at odds?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that happens when we start focusing our attention on deficit reduction is, you know, you pointed out earlier that there are lots of people who will look at Social Security and say, this is an unsustainable program. We've got to, you know, make tough choices and shared sacrifice and all that kind of stuff. We got to get entitlements under control. And if we were to do that and we bought into that, we said, okay, we're going to tackle this budget problem. We're going to pay down the debt. We're going to reduce the deficit to even, you know, further. And one of the big concerns is that we've got problems with entitlements. So we're going to tackle those tough choices. We're going to have to cut benefits. You know, we can't afford to keep promises that we've made to the elderly and their dependents and the disabled. So benefits come down. Well, that's going to have a huge impact on inequality, right? Because this is one of the most important programs. I'm talking about Social Security in terms of keeping the elderly out of poverty. So we start, my concern is that we would end up with something like that, where we start choosing to reform programs or adjust spending and taxes in a way that exacerbates inequality for the purpose of trying to balance the budget and so forth.
All right, so let's talk about inequality. I mean, the Piketty, and this has been the most criticized, I think, part of his book in some respects, suggests, and maybe somewhat offhandedly relative to the rest of his work, but that an international, I guess, a worldwide wealth tax would be the answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we spoke to Thomas Frank, I guess it was a week or two ago, and he was critical of that solution, and I imagine you are too. Tell us why, if that's the case.
No, I think you're right. I read Tom's review of Piketty, and I think it's probably my favorite of all the reviews I've read so far. And I think Tom's right. I mean, I don't know. With the global wealth tax, it just seems to me that getting something like that actually adopted and enforced, and there are so many ways through accounting maneuvers to avoid paying taxes, so that just seems to me on a variety of fronts probably the wrong way to go. And I think that Tom really hits the nail on the head, because he says, look, when inequality was not increasing rapidly, like what we're seeing today, this is the period of time where unions were most strong and most important in the economy. And so he was surprised, and I was surprised, that Tamad does not talk about the importance of strengthening labor, particularly bargaining through unionization. And so, you know, there are a variety of ways to go at inequality. You can, if you just think about, you know, put one hand up high, put one hand down low, and you say, I want to reduce inequality, so I'm going to tax the hell out of the people at the top. Well, that lowers them, and inequality comes down, but it doesn't do anything for the people on the bottom. So what could you do for those on the bottom? How can you address inequality and also make the majority better off? Well, you increase the incomes of those at the bottom. So inequality goes down, but you're helping 99% of the population. And so, you know, I mentioned it, the job guarantee program, but if we had something like that, and some people want to have a program that's really generous. You know, Sandy Darity has been proposing, he's at Duke, for a number of years, a federally funded jobs program where you have wages scaled, and he's got some pretty generous wages, you know, 50,000 and maybe even higher, but then you have a benefits package as well. So you can have, you know, wages and benefits that include health care, vacation time, child care. I mean, you can get as creative as you want with some of this stuff. This would do more to increase the well-being of those at the bottom, and then it would ratchet upward because, you know, depending on how aggressive you get, that becomes the de facto minimum. So any other employer in the economy who wants to hire a worker is going to have to compete with this wage and benefit package, and you can lift an awful lot of people up out of poverty, and I think deal with the sorts of inequality problems that Piketty helps, you know, people really sort of recognize, and the growing problem with programs that are designed to lift those at the bottom.
So, you know, just to be clear, the idea of that, you know, taxation may do something on the top end, and you know, something like, particularly like the estate tax, I think is one of those mm-hmm. things that sort of prevents us from having an aristocracy. But if you really want to tackle inequality, you have to, in conjunction maybe with some other government policies that would strengthen people's ability to unionize and leverage their bargaining power in the economy, you got to spend that money is basically what it comes down
exactly.
to. Right? I mean, that's it's a two-part process. And if you just stop at the taxation and you say we're going to cut the deficit, it doesn't really have the impact that you want to have, other than maybe preventing an aristocracy.
That's exactly right. I agree completely with that.
And I should say that I also think, you know, there is there is a path there, but it's more of a political argument on some level. When you tax the high end, you decrease their ability to direct what the policy outcomes are ultimately with our government. And I am obviously not the first to say that either, but you keep the plutocracy, plutonomy from becoming a plutocracy.
Right. Yeah. So this is another important way of using taxes to influence the social and economic outcomes. Absolutely. So it's not that you have to tax the very wealthy in order to get dollars, because, you know, some people, I read a piece the other day, and the argument was that in order to help the poor, we must tax the rich. That because apparently money grows on rich people, and that's where dollars come from. And so we cannot possibly do anything until we have the acquiescence of those at the very top to higher taxes, which seems to me pretty implausible at this point if Congress is more or less working in the service of those at the very top of the income scale. That why would you want to delay helping those at the bottom until such time as you can get those at the top to agree to higher taxes? I mean, I don't like the idea at all of setting it up that way. But are there good reasons to raise taxes on those at the very top? Absolutely. Should you tie those reasons to funding and make helping those at the bottom contingent on raising taxes on those at the top? I don't think so. I think that's a mistake.
All right, and I know we've held you for quite a while, and I appreciate, but let me just bear with me here. Do you think that there is a growing understanding at the Fed or in other policy circles of this dynamic, that we can actually spend at a time where demand is still so lagging, that we can spend without raising taxes? I mean, this, you know, it's sort of, this is where the sort of the economics and the politics sort of cross intersect on some level, that if there becomes a growing urgency, which I don't know that we'll see, in terms of what needs to be done in the economy, that policymakers will sort of accept this notion that we can actually spend without having to deal with the political implications of trying to raise taxes. Do you have any hope that that message is getting there's some sympathy to that notion in our policy circles?
Well, I always have hope because it keeps me crawling out of bed every day to try to continue to help people understand this stuff. But it's really tough. I think that for me, over the years that I've been doing this, I've come to sort of believe that it's got to come from the bottom up. It's better to try to educate regular Americans and to then have them apply pressure. So when they write to their, you know, congressman and they say, listen, my town needs or my state needs or whatever, and the congressman responds, oh, I'd really love to help you, and gosh, I agree, that's a worthy project, but, you know, we don't have any money. So how are you going to pay for it question? That is, you know, the first line of defense against anything, whether it's infrastructure, education, healthcare, whatever it is, you got to get over that hurdle. How are you going to pay for it? And they, you know, they put their hands up and they say, well, we'd love to help you, but of course there's no money. So as worthy as this is, I have to say no. And the more that constituents turn on them and say, please don't tell me that you don't know where to get the U.S. dollar, okay, because I know where it comes from. And so tell me that you can't and won't spend on this project because you're worried that it's going to be inflationary, because you think that if we try to get the real resources mobilized to fix our infrastructure, that we're going to put too much strain on the economy and we're going to end up with inflation. That I can accept, but don't tell me that you don't know where to come up with the dollar, okay, because that I reject. And so I'm seeing more and more pieces in everything from local newspapers to magazines. People, I think, are waking up to this, and I think the more that message spreads, the more difficult it's going to be for people in Congress to say, you know, no, because it's an affordability question. It's not an affordability question. We've got to get our elected officials focused on what really matters, and that is, do we have the real resources in the economy? Do they exist? Do we have the people? Do we have the raw materials? Do we have the machines and the factories? Is there enough of that sort of stuff that if a government wanted to put those resources to work, move them around in the economy by providing the money, then can we do something significant without causing an inflation problem? And that's the bottom line.
Stephanie Kelton, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics, Editor-in-Chief of the New Economic Perspectives. We will link to that on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, folks. I have to say that I think that because I was so good in not interrupting our Professor Kelton, that I have earned myself the right to play this song.
Hey, shut up.
It's a little indulgence.
Hey, shut up. Shut up. Hey.
I don't think that's the final mix.
Hey.
It wasn't. That was not the final mix. I don't know where the final mix is. I've lost it.
Hey.
Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to do it again. Because I got to get the chess in there.
Hey, shut up.
Do you play chess by any chance?
All right. That's the part I needed to hear. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will talk about Mikey Suits. We will talk about, apparently, Sarah Palin. I don't know why we even still talk about her, but some people still enjoy it. Yeah, because of YouTube traffic. Some people still are interested in hearing what someone who basically just walked away from her job as governor. Like, I'm
not going to milk it by doing it.
I don't want to beat a dead horse by, finishing my term. The world needs me to do a reality show. I can do more by making more money on the circuit than I can by... It's not laziness. Yes, well, she weighs in on the... we'll talk about Benghazi. I there's not much to say other than the Democrats have really... It's just stupid. Stupid. Jamie Dimon, Chipotle. We'll get to that story. We got more. Chris Christie, Mikey Suits, all of it. Folks, this show relies on your membership, your subscriptions, essentially. Obviously, you can subscribe to the show as a podcast. You get the free podcast the first 45 minutes. So I guess today, 55 minutes. You're welcome. For free. But to continue to do this show, we need your support. You can become a member at Majority FM. And as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes. Sometimes it's an hour. Sometimes it's 40 minutes every day. So become a member today at majority.fm. Also, you can support this program by doing virtually nothing. Virtually nothing. Michael's in the corner talking to himself as Sarah Palin.
In a very particular way.
Yeah, in a rather non-family friendly way.
He was doing someone else.
Now I've lost my train of thought. By doing nothing, you can support this program. Virtually nothing. Literally three clicks away. You go to Majority Report kickback.com. That's click number one. You click on the Amazon icon. That's click number two. You bookmark it That's click number three. If you buy crap from Amazon, always buy it through that bookmarked link. We get a kickback. So it's virtually nothing. Three clicks. Less effort than it takes actually to actually put toothpaste on your toothbrush. And I know you do that. I hope you do that at least a couple of times a day. So, and if you want us to be able to continue to provide you great interviews and news commentary and sometimes amusing bits and to give you the hygiene tips that you should be multiple times a day brushing your teeth, you help us out in that way. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code GETMAJORITY. You get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. It helps folks. It pushes us up in the rankings, which introduces more people to the show. And also get our free app at majorityapp.com. Just because it makes me feel better about spending all that money on it. All right, folks, see you in the funner half. The number 6462, what is it? 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM or via the app. We'll take your calls when we get back. Dick Eater.